and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a weekly podcast bringing readers and writers of Australian fiction together. I'm Claudine Tennellis. As an avid reader and passionate advocate for Australian fiction, I make it my mission to spotlight local talent. So if you're looking for your next read or simply want to learn more about the Australian literary scene, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and relax. This episode is brought to you by HarperCollins Australia. In such uncertain geopolitical times, listeners, a book that reflects on war and what we as humans can or have learned about those experiences feels both timely and prescient in many ways. To Sing of War, a novel by Catherine MacKinnon, the Miles Franklin Award shortlisted author of Storyland, is a novel set in the final months of World War II. An epic story that examines the events in the lead up to the United States' decision to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, ending the war in the Pacific and leading to Japan's surrender. Taking us from the Allied campaign in New Guinea to Los Alamos in New Mexico, where Oppenheimer and his team of scientists were involved in a project to build a weapon to stop all war, and then far away to the sacred island of Miyajima in Japan, we are privy to the lives of those caught in that period of time. Alive with breathtaking and heart-wrenching detail, this is a book about conflict, about death, sacrifice, friendship, love, and forgiveness. An unforgettable story from a remarkable storyteller. Now, just by way of background, Catherine lives in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales with her husband and teaches creative writing at the University of Wollongong. Her first novel, The Nearly Happy Family, was published by Penguin in 2008, and as mentioned earlier, Storyland was published by Fourth Estate in 2017. Catherine's plays have been produced nationally, and her short stories, reviews, and essays have appeared in publications that include the Griffith Review, Text Journal, Mianjin, Narrative, and the Sydney Morning Herald. And so it is with great delight that I have the chance to speak with Catherine today, and welcome to the podcast, Catherine.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here, and I'm excited to talk about the book with you.
Congratulations on the publication of To Sing of War, and it's been out for just over a week now. So what does it mean to you to see this book out on the shelves?
Well, it's very exciting, obviously, and it's also great because you have a small amount of feedback from your editors and people that are involved with the book and a couple of, you know, really treasured readers. But until it really gets out to the wider readership, you kind of don't know if it works. And so it's really good to kind of get that feedback. And I've just had just a little bit of feedback now, and not enough yet because it's only just out there. So yeah, it's exciting, and it's interesting to hear what people think and say.
Yeah, indeed. Now, as I've already foreshadowed in my introduction, this is a book that offers some quite unique perspectives to the conclusion of World War II. So I wanted to ask, what made you decide to approach the story in this way?
It's interesting because Storyland has got a kind of background. It focuses on stories, obviously, and that's what I'm most interested in telling a good story. But really what I wanted to do in Storyland was, you know, look at climate change. And so it crosses over different times and landscapes. So you see the land, you feel the land, and I don't even really have to talk about it so much. It's within the story. And so I came from a background of really being interested in climate change. And at the time when I was starting to research To Sing of War, you know, they were talking about the Anthropocene and this, you know, this new era, and scientists were kind of discussing whether they would announce this new era. They ended up not doing that, but only recently. And so for a long time they were looking at it and okay, if we had a new era, like the Holocene or, you know, various eras, when would it have begun? And there were various articles looking at that, and one of them pitched the first atomic test as when that era might have begun. And you know, I grew up in a period when there was a lot of movies about nuclear war. There was events happening that we knew about, the Cuban Missile Crisis, all that sort of stuff. And so I started researching first off the test, first atomic test that was in Alamogordo, and the building of the atomic bomb. And so I was just looking at that and thinking, oh, maybe I'd write a long short story. What will I do? And I'd really love this short story by Jim Shepard. I don't know if you know that writer. He's American. And he wrote one on Chernobyl. And that I'd read it years ago and thought, oh, yeah, maybe I could do something like that. And then one night I was chatting with my dad on the phone. He'd come out of ICU. And we were talking about, he'd had a kind of It's funny, he sort of started talking almost as if he'd had some very dream experience in the ICU unit. He said the pipes were making these noises and it was really haunting and bringing back these memories. It's one of those conversations where you sort of, it gets a bit delicate because you're talking about death, and he's also perhaps, you know, talking about things that happened in the war. He had never talked about it much before, so this was a new conversation. He told us kids that he drove a leisure boat in the war, which he did do, but after the war, he, you know how there's a repatriation time. He did drive a leisure boat after the war with two other soldiers and two Japanese soldiers. So that's kind of interesting story in itself. So he just started to talk a little bit, not about his experiences, but those haunting memories. And then he asked me what I was working on. And I said, you know, I'm researching this. And he said, oh, I've got a story for you. And he told me about near the end of the war, him being up on a ridge, the Japanese on the other side, that neither of them had much ammunition, so they weren't firing. And just the experience of being there, and then across the wireless came this message to them that an atomic bomb had been dropped, and they'd never heard the word before. And so they were going, what, where's the bomb? You know, can't see it. It's not over there. It's not, maybe it's somewhere else in New Guinea. They didn't know much about it. And eventually the news came through, more reports came through, and they realized it had been dropped on Japan and the war was going to end. But yes, and it was just that experience of the confusion. And I suppose he started then telling me more stories, and I think the two bits of research started to come together. And that sort of was the start of the novel.
I can only imagine the depth of research that went into constructing this novel. So I wanted to ask you, how long did it take you to write?
A long time, because I started researching. So it's hard to say exact in years, but I did start researching before I finished Storyland. So I started researching in about 2015, 2016, doing bits and pieces of research. And then Storyland was finished and published in 2017. So I went on researching from then. So it's hard to say, you know, that's a period across 8 years, I guess, but I wasn't writing all that time.
Yeah, fantastic. All right. So for the benefit of those listeners who haven't yet read this book, I was wondering if you could tell us more about the story.
The first thing to say is it crosses three lands. It crosses New Guinea and New Mexico in the United States and Japan. And it's Miyajima in Japan that it's mainly set, and Los Alamos in New Mexico, and also near Alamogordo, where the Trinity site, where the first atomic test was. So it crosses those three lands. It starts in New Guinea. It's December 1944, and there's a young nurse, Lottie Wild. She's kind of intelligent, keen to learn. Not many women went to war at that period, so a whole lot of nurses were allowed to go to New Guinea, and they were interested, compelled to do something good, but also interested to go to this country and work. And she meets a past love, her first love, Virgil Nicholson, and they meet as she's setting up a nursing station. They've got a troubled past, and so they have to work in this hot climate. They have to sort of deal with jungle and with fighting the Japanese. And then also they have this sort of personal relationship. And then it goes over to New Mexico, and it's up in Los Alamos, where it was a military compound. So it was a place surrounded by barbed wire with guards, and a group of scientists from all over the world were gathered there to build, they believed, a weapon that would stop all war. And it takes up three characters there, Robert Oppenheimer, Kitty Oppenheimer, and a young scientist called Mim Carver, and follows their journey in building that weapon. And then it kind of goes over to the island of Miyajima, and there's a mother there who runs an inn with her husband's grandmother, and it follows her experiences, the inn services, or has as clientele the Japanese military, and events happen there that where she has to make a tough decision. So it jumps between those three countries and braided stories, and it goes from December through to August in 1945.
I must admit that I was quite fascinated by the chapters which you've set in Los Alamos. Most of those who are listening will probably have heard of the recent Hollywood blockbuster about Oppenheimer, which was released last year, but I haven't watched it. So I actually knew very little about his role in the development of the atomic bomb and the testing. And as you say, that part of the story was actually split into three different points of view, which in itself was quite fascinating to me. Robert Oppenheimer, then there was Kitty Oppenheimer, and then there was Miriam Carver, or Mim. Tell me more about that decision to split this part of the story into those three points of view, and what were you hoping to achieve by doing so?
Okay, great question. A couple of reasons. I mean, I was fascinated by Robert Oppenheimer. He is really an interesting character to research and think about. And, you know, at first I wasn't sure who was going to be in that part of the story. You know, he's a very eccentric, intelligent human being. He loved literature. He read really widely. He read ancient texts. He read modern texts. He was just a really different kind of scientist. And I find a lot of scientists, because they have to think outside the box, they actually often are really interesting people, open to lots of ideas. So he was really interesting to research, and I wanted him to be in there. And also because he was very involved with making the decision to drop the bomb. And I was kind of interested in looking at the complexity around that, what pressures were on him at that time, why did people make that decision? A lot of the scientists in the research that I did, when it came near the end, once Hitler had committed suicide, they were not keen to go on, and there was a lot of discussion around that time. So I was interested in all of that. But I read about a lot of women that were involved in Los Alamos. And so I wanted to have a young female scientist because there were several. There weren't, you know, as many women, obviously, as men, but there were women, and we so rarely hear about them. And there were so many young people as well. You know, Oppenheimer was early 40s, and he was one of the elders, you know, whereas there were lots of people, lots of scientists, heaps in their 20s. So it was a very fervent, youthful environment, and they were making these huge decisions, doing this intense work. So I wanted to get those different perspectives in. And also I wanted to get Kitty. I put Kitty in because I wanted to take it to contrast the big national decision with also what was happening in terms of violence in a personal relationship. Look at that difference. Kitty was not well portrayed in history. You know, there's no context given for her position, but she was born in Germany and came to America as a young girl. And she was kind of trapped in this place with nothing to do because that heritage kind of cast her in a particular light, even though she was married to the director. And both of them were being pursued as being, even Robert, while he was managing this whole thing, was being followed all the time, thought to be a communist. So, you know, there was a lot of pressure on them. And it was just looking at all that pressure and what that did and how that played out in the decisions that they made. Just really interesting. So just trying to kind of weave them all together. So it's sort of seen in a more, you know, every time we do something, there's all these different things playing on our decisions. It's easier to do and look at that in a novel than it is in a film.
How did you go about getting inside their heads for this? Because, I mean, they're very personal points of view, and they're actual historical characters. So how do you write these historical characters and get inside their heads?
I always do lots of lengthy portraits, almost like little biographies that I write, you know, about them. So I do a lot of work, and I work on both the left and right side of the brain. So sometimes I just free write, and then I do a lot of research. I kind of put those two things together, and I look for things in there. If I'm working on an historical person, like a real person, and trying to bring them back to life, I look for things that might have shaped their life in particular. And so, for example, there's one that I used in Robert Oppenheimer. You follow your nose a bit as a writer, and what sort of seems to speak to you from their story. So with Robert Oppenheimer, there was this story about when he was a young boy. He was an eccentric kid. He went to, it was called an ethical culture school, and they had a lot of ethics, you know, for their 5, 6, and 7 year olds. And he was a kind of outstandingly brilliant as a young kid, but that made him a kind of an outsider. He just had eccentric interests, even for someone so young. He liked to collect sort of stones and different things. He was sent to camp one summer, and at this camp, he wasn't having a great time, and he wrote a letter home to his parents and said, having a great time, learning heaps about sex. And he meant it as a joke, one assumes. And his father had a bit of a ribald humour. I assume he was trying to appeal to that. Anyway, his parents did not take it well, and they immediately went to camp. and complain to the director of the camp. I mean, everyone can sort of identify that, either as a parent or as a kid, you know, when your parents come and interfere at a time when you just don't want them to, and it makes it worse for you and your group, or as a parent being worried about your child. Anyway, it made it so much worse for Robert because the director told off all the kids and they ganged up on him. One night, they dragged him into the ice house, you know, with huge blocks of ice just in this house. They stripped him of his clothes and they got green paint and they painted his balls and his buttocks green. Then they took his clothes, shut the door, and they left him there all night in the dark, you know, just on the edge of the forest. It was just really hideous experience. And in the morning, they opened the door and said, "You tell anyone, we're going to get you." And so he never mentioned it to his parents. He later in life told a teacher who took him, a teacher was employed to take him on a holiday to New Mexico the first time he went there. And he told that teacher, and that's why we know about it now. And it just seemed to kind of really, first of all, he really was very stoic. He stayed at the camp. He put up with it, but he kept that thing secret from the world. And it's such a kind of outsider story, something to hold close. So I use that story to try and help explain his complex relationship with America, because he loved America. He talked about it all the time as loving America, but he had a complex relationship with not being always included in society. So like when he went to Cambridge, he was definitely an outsider there. He was not well liked. So he had, at times in his life, he had great difficulty fitting in. And yet he managed to run Los Alamos in a way that all the scientists said he was brilliant at running it and making a community. So it was one of the strong points of his life where this man who wanted to belong got a chance to belong, even though the outcome of it is incredibly horrific. So again, just complexity.
Indeed, and I love that nuanced portrayal of him in this story. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, I think at one point he reflects on that awful childhood experience and then kind of juxtaposes that with this, now I'm working, you know, so closely with the President of the United States and I'm responsible for making this incredibly important decision. And so that was quite an interesting arc for his character, yeah. I guess you could say. So Los Alamos was a secret compound which Oppenheimer and his team of scientists were contained on during the development and testing phase of the atomic bomb, as you mentioned. And obviously security surrounding the design of this weapon was a major issue at that time, wasn't it?
Yep, it was, absolutely. Each department was not allowed to know about what the other department was doing, but the core scientists were allowed to, they had to. Originally, General Groves, who was in charge of everything, not just Los Alamos, but all the uranium plants and the whole Manhattan Project was a big project with different factories across America, an enormous undertaking. So he originally didn't want the scientists to have, you know, a weekly gathering to talk about, you know, issues, but Oppenheimer insisted that they could never progress unless they did. So the core group of top scientists could meet together and they all knew what was going on because they had to discuss, how will we solve the implosion problem, you know, this week? You know, what will we try? There were grades of knowledge and there were key tags for where you could go in the complex and they were color-coded. So certain people could go certain places. And so only, you know, a certain number of people had, I think it was white, could have been white or blue, which got you in everywhere.
I guess that was one of the things that I didn't really appreciate about Robert's relationship with his wife, Kitty, was that was a source of quite a lot of tension between them, that there were things, I mean, she was the wife of the director and she wasn't allowed to know a lot of things that were happening.
That's all recorded and documented. It's true. And I think the thing that's not normally put in the history books is there were just so many aspects about her life. When she was young, she had fallen in love with a communist and she'd helped hand out pamphlets. And he had then gone on to fight in Franco and had been killed. And so that was a very early relationship when she was really young. But of course, anything to do with any communist link was seen as problematic. And so they really did. It was a really difficult situation for her because before that, she and Robert seemed to have this relationship where they talked a lot. They had great friends, Charlotte and Bob Serber, who lived above their garage. And so they were this group that drank together a lot. They had lots of parties. They talked science. And so she's taken from that world where she feels part of it and she's engaged with the community to Los Alamos, where she's not allowed to do anything but just have drinks with the wives. It didn't please her to be excluded. She just wanted to do something.
And suffice it to say, there were people that were involved in the project, and even Oppenheimer himself questioned the morality of what they were doing. And I think at one point of the story, Mim starts to question the development of what they collectively refer to as the gadget, and likens the project to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, that they are Frankenstein and the gadget is their monster. And I guess what she was trying to say was that just because it could be done doesn't mean that it should be done. I wondered if you could talk more about this and why this was something you wanted to explore in the novel.
Yes. So Mim is friends in the novel with someone called Fred Johnson. And Fred Johnson is actually based on a real figure. Ted Hall was his name, a young scientist who was at Los Alamos and was so concerned about what America was doing. And you've got to remember that Niels Bohr was a very famous scientist at the time, and he came to Los Alamos and he talked to them. He didn't work there with them on the bomb necessarily, but he talked to them about the project. And he was trying to get the American president and Churchill to sort of open up to the Russians, because he thought if they didn't, after the war, they'd have a Cold War situation. So he was quite right in that. And they thought he was crazy in the end. However, he told this to the scientists, and Ted Hall kind of, you know, there was a lot of talk about it. So he decided, the real person, Ted Hall, decided to go and tell the Russians. He wouldn't give them everything, but he'd give them enough information so that after the war, it wouldn't only be America that had all the knowledge about the bomb, and that would level it out. There would be more people sharing in this knowledge. Therefore, no one could hold that threat over anyone else. And also, he was a little bit outraged that the Russians were excluded from Los Alamos, given that they were allies in the war against the Germans. Yeah, those two things, as a young person, outraged him. And so I used Fred and Mim as a kind of emblematic of those young people who are just like people are today with climate change, are just saying, you know, what are you doing? Why are you not paying attention to this? And so their way of doing it in this closed community was to share secrets with the Russians.
Let's move to New Guinea. And in this part of the novel, we meet a cast of colourful and tragic characters as Virgil and his company mates are charging through the jungle in search of Japanese soldiers to neutralise. Now, Virgil asks himself repeatedly and is preoccupied with this notion of what it is to be a man. He's searching for the good part of war, if there ever is such a thing. Maybe it's finding friendship or finding love. And I think it's in the jungle of New Guinea that this novel really comes alive. The sights, the sounds, the smells, the deprivation, the horror. But there were also moments of joy. And I heard you say earlier that your father was in New Guinea. And so can you tell me more about that and why this was something you wanted to portray in your novel?
You know, as we're talking about it, the stories seemed to just merge together naturally. And it just felt like they could go together, all based around this link with the atomic bomb. And my father, when he was started, you know, very late in life to open up and talk a little bit about it. And a couple of the things that he said, first of all, a few things happened after the war, and I won't mention them because they're in the novel, that kind of disturbed him and upset him about war. But when he was there fighting, he said a couple of things. They had a year's jungle training in Queensland before they went up. And he said that, you know, although they were going to war at the time, it was the fittest he ever felt, and he felt part of a group. And he said he really liked that time, you know, doing the jungle training. He said, I was just so fit. It was just, I felt really kind of good. And then they went to New Guinea. And interestingly, the jungle had always been in his childhood imagination, Tarzan. They did actually used to kind of go across the river, you know, thinking they were Tarzan. Tarzan was big at the time, I guess the 30s, actually. Mm. The jungle, just the jungle, the plants, the animals, he was really fascinated by it. And he was also kind of upset, really, that these three countries had come to this beautiful place and were at war in it. As he went on from being there day one through to the last days that he was there, you know, there was a big change in obviously his attitude to war. All this time he was just, every time he would just be amazed at the jungle and the landscape and the beauty of it, and this sort of pain that he felt about the fact that, yeah, they were at war in this beautiful place. So that came from his real experience. I mean, Virgil, the character of Virgil in the novel, got a lot of my father's experience in it. I mean, it's a fictional character. He wanted me to make all the characters fictional, and they are fictional, but they draw from real stories and real people's lives. And part of the reason I wanted to call him Virgil was also to kind of link back to the myths, the Greek myths that we learn about, the Trojan War, because our ideas of war are linked back to that as well. They're in our minds as we go through any war experience. And so it links back to those stories as well.
There was Virgil and his company, along with the New Guinean men who fought alongside them. And then the other side of that part of the war effort was the medics. And so we come to Lottie Wilde and the team at Atapi. And it's through Lottie that we learn about how fear shapes our behaviour. Where did the inspiration for Lottie's character come from?
Yeah, look, nothing is direct. Everything's indirect. And for a while, I knew I wanted to write Lottie, but I just, you know, write bits of narrative and then I just have a big blank page. And I knew things about her. And part of the things about Lottie are actually based on my mother. And one of the really, my mother was not a nurse. While I followed actually my father's platoon through the war, all those events, you know, happened to a particular platoon, maybe not exactly in the order they're in the novel, but they happened. But the things that I took from my mother were for Lottie, one of the difficult things was something that happened to her when she was very young that she never actually spoke about in her life, not to me. The only person she ever told was my father. And so therefore, part of the novel is interested in these secrets that we keep for life and what they do. So one of the things that happened to my mother was that, and it also happened to my aunt actually, was that she was raped several times in her home in the war years. I won't go into that, but I really wanted to bring the idea of what happens to women and rape in war into this story in some way. It's absolutely a fictional story. You know, it's not based on anything to do with my mother, except the idea that women suffer rape so much and often, really, really often, even today, don't talk about it. And sometimes, you know, I'm a teacher, I teach creative writing, and maybe about 5 years ago, I got a playwright in and we were going to do a project with our students. And we sat down and we talked to them and said, what kind of violence do you deal with? Not really believing or understanding, not knowing ahead of time, the amount of violence that they would talk about. We both came away from that discussion and workshop in shock, actually, at what young people are dealing with in terms of, especially young women, but also young men, gay boys, and even some of the boys in that group talked about their ability to fight. So it was just a really interesting workshop, but horrifying. So I think violence is really in our lives still. So I was just interested to kind of compare intimate and small acts of violence between two people and this kind of, you know, broad national violence. I mean, I just think it's interesting how much violence we allow into our lives.
And I think one of the really interesting things about Lottie was that while she has to work to overcome her fears, she reflects that it's not just in war that women live in fear, but that we, and these are her words, that we're always at war, always under threat. And I think in the context of what you have just said, and in the context of current conversations that we are having around women's safety in our country at the moment, her words are so powerful.
Often when you talk to friends and you say, look, every time I've walked down a dark street at night, I look over my shoulder and worry and I plot it. You know, as soon as you talk to male friends about that, they go, really? Do you? Every time? And you go, yeah. You see someone suspicious, you cross the road. You know, it's almost, we don't even think about it. We just do it all the time. Whereas men don't do that. They actually don't. So that discussion is just really interesting. Women live their lives quite differently in terms of that fear that's often there. You know, when I was young, there were heaps of Reclaim the Night protest marches and all of that sort of thing, but it's still occurring, you know, it's still out there. And so we have not addressed it.
Catherine, I don't want to forget to talk about Hiroko and her family and the glimpse we get into their lives in the time just before the bombs are dropped. And I think through her perspective, it hits home for me that the ordinary person in the context of war is placing their faith in their governments and their leaders to steer them through the troubled waters of global conflict, doing what duty requires of them. The same could be said for the Allied forces in New Guinea. Even Oppenheimer himself justifies his actions as just doing what the government is asking of him. And yet for Hiroko and her family, her country, the outcome is catastrophic, isn't it?
Everyone had a part to play in the war. So the story's not doing that. It is, as you say, looking at what happens to individuals and their lives and what they're meant to give up. On the island of Miyajima, there's this flame that's been going for over 1,200 years. It's been burning, which is kind of amazing. It's a very peaceful place to go up the top of Mount Misson. People go on pilgrimages still. And there were in the forest of Mount Misson bonsai plants that were used to create bonsai. And one of those plants was given as a gift. It was developed by a bonsai master in Hiroshima, and he gave it as a gift to America after the war. And it's in an American plant kind of museum now. But just that link of peace, I wanted to kind of bring a little bit of that in. So the story of living at that place in the forest in around Mount Misson, you're not allowed to cut down trees, you're not allowed to hurt animals. That's always been the case. Deer roam there all the time. They're a kind of sacred animal. And I just wanted that little contrast to be there in amongst all the horror of the war as well. If you go to Hiroshima now, and also Nagasaki, it's a very sobering place. But also what's really quite beautiful about Hiroshima, the Peace Park is quite a spiritual place to be. And there's so many young people in Hiroshima. It's quite joyful as a place, the actual town. And yet the Peace Park is much more sobering, but also kind of spiritual in a way. So it was something about and going to Hiroshima and going to Nagasaki, learning about all the different things that happened in more detail, you know, reading through the oral histories there. I mean, it's devastating to read everything, but especially the aftermath and what happened. And, you know, they did really know what they were going to do. They did know the devastation that they were going to cause. And yet once they dropped the bombs, a lot of people and a lot of the scientists were horrified, and it started the anti-bomb movement. And yet they knew beforehand, you know, really, they just didn't stop to think. I suppose that's what I write about in the novel, the complexity of it all. So, yeah, it's pretty devastating, but it's also kept, Hiroshima and Nagasaki have kept kind of a place where we can go to and contemplate war and what's happened, and it's actually quite a good thing to do.
So, Catherine, you might know that there are many writers who listen to this podcast, and given your experiences as a teacher in creative writing, no less, I wondered if you had any tips for writers out there.
I mean, I think one of the things about novel writing is that it is a long journey and you have to stay with it. I actually think that's one of the hardest things. You know, short stories you can write briefly, you can get one written in a week. Some you can write sometimes without much thought. You can just sit down sometimes in an afternoon or two and dash off a draft and it'll work. Not always, but sometimes. But a novel is a real commitment. You know, it's like a really committed relationship. And you have to give up things. You have to give up things on the weekend. You have to give up going out with friends at times. To write this, I had to give up all my holidays for the last 4 years. So not really had a day off. Otherwise, I just couldn't get it done with a full-time job. It's commitment. So first of all, I think one of the tips is you have to know I can be that committed person to get to the end. And if you can, that's great. And if you can't, just think about whether there's other ways to shape the story that you can make it within the time. I don't think it means you can't write. I think you've got to think, okay, how could I do this story? Or could I do this story as a novel in stories? Or could I do this story as a book of short stories? You know, just ways that you can achieve what you want to achieve with your life context. So, yeah, and I think it's enjoyable. I think writing is a very enjoyable, you know, experience. If you can get over I don't know about you, but once you're in that fictional world, I'm always quite happy. It's quite a happy place for me to be in that world. And I think it's a little bit like, you know, drugs or whatever, you know, you're free of other inhibitions. And so you're in that world and you can do whatever you like. It's kind of quite a nice place to be. When I was young, really quite young, there was a big thing about going to clairvoyance. And so I think myself and my friends used to go to them all the time. And there was one really, you know, they do the charts and they do your moon charts and they do this chart. And one said to me once, in your chart, you're either going to be in the world of drugs or you're going to be in the world of fiction. So luckily I'm in the world of fiction.
Are you working on something else at the moment?
No, I'm trying to. I'm not sure what I'm going to do next. I'm just trying different ideas out and playing around with ideas. So I haven't got anything fixed. And, you know, I've just written a short story actually about Kitty and Jean Tatlock, Robert Oppenheimer's former lover before Kitty. You know, I've just written a short story at the moment. I'm just playing around. I'm not really sure where I'm going to go. No. I mean, I want to not take as long this time. Unlike other people who had COVID and said, oh, I wrote my novel. If you were a teacher in COVID, it was like horrendous because, you know, you were teaching writing and all your students were stressed and, you know, you had to learn how to go online and it was so much harder. You know, I had no time in COVID to do any writing. And so it took longer than I wanted. And I definitely want to take a shorter time next time to get the next novel out.
I was so moved and impressed by this incredible story. It was so unique. It was insightful and thought-provoking, an absolute must-read for lovers of historical fiction. Thank you, Catherine, for joining me on Talking Aussie Books today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was just really lovely to talk with you.
That's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please drop me a line via my webpage at claudinetonellis.com, via Instagram, Facebook or Twitter. Alternatively, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Until next time, happy reading!